It's December 24th, 2014. Merry Christmas, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. First, we're going to cover some local science and tech stories. Then Mark Huckel from the Pacific Telecommunications Council will tell us about their upcoming PTC conference.
And finally, we'll talk supercomputers from the University of Hawaii's new Cray Cluster to putting powerful research applications into the cloud. Gwen Jacobs and Jason Lee are here from UH to tell us all about it.
Have your questions and thoughts ready to call in or tweet, but first the headlines.
Well, the research vessel Falkor, featured earlier in this year on Bite Mark Cafe, returned from its latest Pacific expedition last week. The objective was to explore the Mariana Trench, located near Guam, the deepest point on Earth. Led by co-chief scientists from the University of Hawaii's School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology, the month-long voyage broke deep-sea records and yielded many discoveries, including the world's deepest fish.
The research team found a completely unknown species of fish at a depth of 26,700 feet. That beats the previous record by 500 feet. The fish had a broad wing-like fins, an eel-like tail, and glided slowly along the bottom of the trench. The team also collected the deepest rock samples ever obtained from the inner slope of the trench, yielding specimens that represent some of the earliest volcanic eruptions of the Mariana Island archipelago.
As part of the Haddle Ecosystem Studies Project, the scientists sampled a broad spectrum of environments using five deep-sea vehicle landers at specifically targeted depths from 16,000 feet to over 34,000 feet. UH oceanography professor Jeff Drazen said in a statement, many studies have rushed to the bottom of the trench, but from an ecological view that is very limiting, it's like trying to understand a mountain ecosystem by only looking at its summit. Now, I thought the video that they captured of this newly discovered fish was just fascinating. I mean, it looked like something out of Avatar. I mean, the fins were so ephemeral, you know, and it was kind of, you know, swimming around the lidded part of that the structure. And I'm sure that this is probably the first time it's ever seen
anything else.
Something bright.
Or, yeah, actually, it probably. The question is, what awareness would it have?
Yeah.
Of that, but the amount of pressure down there is incredible. Now, I think you might recall when we talked about the Nereus expedition a few months ago. They were in the deep sea, and their little sphere was crushed, basically imploded by the weight. Actually, this expedition lost a very similar sphere that was doing audio recordings at that depth. So if there's any reminder that, you know, it's not just, you know, a scuba dive happening here, you know, thousands of dollars of equipment being lost, but they are basically, they said they broke so many records on this. So very impressive for
sure. Yeah, I'll put up the link to that video. It's really worth checking out.
Well, there is another island named Hawaii in this country now, you may have heard. It was born, though, out of a rude, crude, but hilarious card game. Cards Against Humanity, which launched thanks to a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign 3 years ago, has purchased a private island in Maine and named it Hawaii 2. The card game company bought the island as part of its annual holiday fundraiser, in which over 250,000 fans paid $15 each to participate in the 10 days of whatever of Kwanzaa. Now each of those fans have a deed that grants them a license to use 1 square foot of Hawaii 2.
Well, the island purchase announced today as the 10th and final day of the mystery gifts actually closed on Halloween. According to public records, the Portland Press-Herald reported that the name of the company formed by the game company is Hawaii 2 LLC. Organizers say the idea came after they realized a previous fundraiser raised enough money to buy a small island. So this is what they did. And thanks to a connection at Google and Google Maps search for Hawaii 2 in Maine, indeed drops a pin on the former Birch Island in St. George Lake.
As for why they chose the name Hawaii 2, co-creator Max Temkin told the Press-Herald, it's the main island. Maine, as in the state of Maine. Anyway, of course, the main point of the campaign was to raise funds for charity, and the game company notes that the purchase of the island allows them to preserve a pristine bit of American wilderness. But the year's main beneficiary was the nonprofit Sunlight Foundation. $250,000 was donated to the foundation, which advocates for open government around the world and specifically using technology to make government more accountable and accessible.
Well, you know, when I read this story, I think everything was a big fat joke except for this one $250,000 going to Sunlight Foundation. But if any of you have been a Kickstarter sponsor of this Hawaii 2 purchase, you actually can do whatever you want with 1 square foot of that island.
Right. They said you can plant a flag on it and such, but for the most part, obviously, you're not going to be able to do anything particularly destructive to the environment.
You can't hurt anybody.
But I actually know people that, you know, that participated in it. And of course, when you gave them $15, you had no idea what you were going to get. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm kicking myself, the reason why I didn't participate is that they also did a Black Friday promotion where they said, if you give us money, we'll send you a box of...
dirt.
No, bull droppings. Specifically saying that, you know, Black Friday is just a big pile of bull droppings.
Oh,
so
yeah.
they actually sent out boxes. I said, okay, I really don't need that. That's funny, but I'm not interested. But yes, this is actually real. This island is Hawaii 2, owned by Hawaii 2 LLC. So now the jokes are flying, basically, because at least that's real estate that you can afford in Hawaii.
Great. Okay, and finally, a couple of events on the tech calendar to close out this year. Friday brings the monthly Bite Marks Geek Lunch. We've been hosting this casual gathering for over a decade. And, of course, anyone with an interest in tech is invited to join us. There's no agenda, no presentations, and no sponsors. Just local geeks eating and talking story. We'll be meeting up this Friday, December 26th at Nico's at Pier 38. And, of course, you can RSVP by looking for Bite Marks Lunch on Facebook or just show up.
Now, this has been a tradition. I was going through my Flickr photos, and they go back to 2004.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Of course, there's been as few as the two of us showing up.
That's right.
But sometimes 30. So it'd be great.
You're not even counting the ones that I just show up.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
Also, don't forget Monday, December 29th, brings the 15th annual Holiday Tech Fair. The Holiday Tech Fair is combined with the monthly Wetware Wednesday networking mixer, and it's part tech expo and part job fair. It showcases local tech companies and activities for Kama'aina, as well as expats that are home for the holidays and looking for opportunities to come back to the islands. There'll be resume evaluations and free headshots taken starting at 4 p.m. The tech fair itself kicks off an hour later, and at 6 o'clock, the Pauhana Mixer. This event is at the Japanese Cultural Center. Again, that is Monday, and it's free.
And a little birdie told me that our new governor might even show up.
Well, there's a
reason to go. I think so. And now joining us is Mark Huckel from the Pacific Telecommunications Council to tell us about an upcoming PTC conference. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
Now, I'm going to ask you, how many years has this conference been going on? Were you like 10 years old when it started?
I was, yeah, I wish. I wasn't there at the very first one. I came in about the third or fourth one, but this is now our 37th consecutive year.
So you were 10 years old when it
not quite, but
now, you know, telecommunications, you know, I've been sort of involved with the telecommunications industry for many, many years. And of course, PTC has been an international. It continues to be an international conference, and it brings players from basically all over Asia to Hawaii. How has it changed? I mean, before, telecom used to be kind of the big thing. I mean, there's a lot of money, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of technology. Has the content of the conference changed over the years?
Oh, absolutely. And an organization like PTC would never survive such a long time if it did not also evolve with the industries and the way the industry changes. We started off in an era where there was mostly monopoly telecom operators throughout the world. You might remember a company called AT&T that had nice black phones for you in your homes. Those days, of course, are long gone. AT&T still remains quite an interesting player in its own right through all its machinations of baby bells and then on to other things. Mm-hmm. Now they're one of the biggest mobile operators in this country. Likewise, in other countries, monopoly operators are on the wane. The globalization and liberalization of markets, private ownership of many companies throughout the world, has seen a tremendous explosion of the use of telecommunications. And, of course, add the Internet on top of that. Many of those telecom companies are big players in the Internet, of course, as ISPs. Add mobile on top of that. Add all the ICT players on top of that with cloud computing, as your next guest might allude to. And you have quite a mashup now. Mm-hmm. And PTC reflects that. In fact, we are quite a mashup now. Sure, there's the core members, I suppose, from the wholesale days of telecoms that are still a big part because that's a big part of the international business. But we also have the likes of Google, Facebook, Apple, who are there doing deals, a lot of business meetings at PTC. They're acquiring networks in Hawaii from all the network providers that come here to PTC.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely want to hear a little bit more about some of these other companies that you might say have built their business on the infrastructure that the larger companies, the international providers, have. But you did mention that there's deals being made. I mean, there's the presentations, there's the expo itself, but certainly the conversations in the hallways and in the suites of the hotel probably are very important. One of the things that we cover on Bite Marks Cafe quite a bit, it's probably just a personal passion of ours, is undersea cables and trans-Pacific cables. Right. There's the Hawaiki cable project. There's a couple that Hawaiian Telecom is involved in. Is undersea cables going to be one of the big themes?
Oh, absolutely. They are a core constituency at PTC. All the undersea cable operators are there. They along with a lot of the consultants that work with them, all of the vendor companies that work with them, and the connectivity across the Pacific, of course, continues to expand enormously, even to places where even a few years ago it didn't seem like it would be financially possible to put undersea cables to some remote Pacific islands, and that is now a possibility. And the interconnection with them, with carriers in each country, with satellite operators, et cetera, is just an extraordinary mix of people, and they are all at PTC.
Can we draw anything from the fact that it seemed like we went decades before any of these cables stopped here? Basically, technology got so good that they could fly past us, just like the airlines?
Gosh, this has always been an issue. We like to think of Hawaii as you know, the center of the Pacific and the crossroads of the Asia Pacific, but geographically, it actually doesn't make a lot of sense to land cable here going across the Pacific from North America to East Asia anymore. And because of the sophistication of these cables and that you don't need a lot of extra boosters and amplifiers and things in them, it's possible to run extraordinary lengths through the most direct route. So Hawaii doesn't necessarily become a landing point that is needed in the infrastructure.
Right, and then, you know, in terms of landing here, the idea of actually landing requires you to get a whole bunch of permits and rights of ways and agreements with companies.
That's definitely an issue. Where will you land those cables? Is there a provision for that? And what are the regulations, the rules, the permitting, all of that that goes with that? Is there the surrounding infrastructure? Because it's not just landing the cable, then it has to get into network infrastructure and that. And so it's a difficult choice sometimes, but for those cables that do land, it is possible to make those arrangements in Hawaii.
Now, Mark, what's the makeup of this conference? Well, first, I understand, I've always known it's a large conference, but how many people, and is it private sector mostly? Is it a mix of private and government? What do we see there?
Yeah, we'll probably be around 1,800 in terms of actual registered participants to the program. That's about 50% senior vice president, CEO, CXO type folks. There's another, we estimate, probably around 2,500 to 3,000 that are there for the meetings also. So while every company is registered, they'll have some people that attend the conference, and then the rest of their team is there for the business meetings that surround the conference. Mm-hmm. It is largely private sector. It's commercial operators throughout the Asia Pacific region. We have people coming from about 65 countries, and the makeup, though, is very mixed. We have government officials that are there. We have a deputy minister from Japan coming this year, a couple of officials from China, a lady coming from the new China Bureau of Informatization. We'll be talking about China-U.S. relations and things like that with them. And we have regulators from around the world. We have policymakers, and then a whole host of people that surround the industry as well. So lawyers, obviously, financial people, venture capitalists, they're all there.
Is there going to be a flash session on North Korea?
No, but, you know, we do have three sessions on cybersecurity this year. And two of them actually will be focused. One of them is going to focus on U.S.-China relations. And the other is going to focus on cybersecurity in East Asia. And so that will,
I think,
sure,
that one is probably
up.
Being chaired by
Professor Tsuchiyo. I think you met him.
Well, he was on a show.
The other week. Terrific gentleman, very knowledgeable in this area, and we're just really happy to have him at PTC this year.
What are some of the other themes? We talked about undersea cables, but like you said, it's diverse. You have companies that, to me, would be more content companies writing these that may or may not be present. So what are the big pillars of this conference?
A lot of it is the infrastructure people. Mm-hmm. So it's the undersea cable, it's the satellite operators, it's the carriers. But then we also have the content delivery network people, the people who actually put together networks, whether virtual or actual infrastructure, that deliver content, so your video caching and all
Akamai,
that throughout the world, right, yeah. Akamai and that. And then the data center folks from around the world, so all the big ones like Equinix and NTT and some of the others that have huge presence throughout the world in terms of data center operations. So it's folks like that that are all part of the telecom conglomerate now that are there.
Are there things that are perhaps interesting or appealing to the local audience?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you position yourself. I suppose one of the interesting things we're going to do this year, and we're really pleased about this, is NHK, the national broadcaster in Japan, is mm-hmm. coming, and they are bringing with them their prototype 8K television system. They're actually bringing two sets of them. And they're going to be demonstrating that at PTC, and we're also going to have that open to the public. We can maybe mention how people can attend later here. But just this is an enormous step up in the broadcast world and its convergence into telecoms, obviously, because of the huge implications of the enormous data rates that 8K is generating and whether networks will or could eventually handle that.
Well, I find it fascinating because the people are saying that we are just coming into the time where 4K, mm-hmm, 4K right. could possibly, in the best neighborhoods with the best internet, stream and give you these beautiful pictures that are almost real.
Yeah.
And now you're saying, oh, guess what?
Guess what? There's
twice
more.
Yes.
No, 16 times HDTV, actually.
16
so
times.
What happens is, 4K is coming online. You're seeing it in some theaters already. You're seeing it in some video distributors already. And some production houses are producing in 4K. We don't have broadcasters doing that yet, but it's coming. In other countries, we're a little bit faster than we are here in the U.S. on that. We'll move into 4K. What Japan is doing, though, is taking yet another step and going into 8K. They plan on starting national broadcasting of 8K in 2020 over the air. So that's a phenomenal feat to push that much data out over a broadcast.
Well, what kind of data rates are we talking about?
Huge. I was in a discussion with one of their engineers so that we could get our information correct about it, and I was trying to calculate that myself. And when you do the multiplication of, pixels in the frames times the frame rate times, et cetera, et cetera, I came up with 48 gig per second. And they said, no, because of some redundancies and other things, it's going to be 144 gigabits per second.
Okay, well, we'll
so
have
try
to,
that on your iPhone.
Yes, or get your ISP. Get your ISP ready for that speed boost.
So it's huge data rates, right? And the caching of that, storing of that, the transport, the et cetera, et cetera.
Is there an opportunity for the public to view this 8K demonstration?
Yeah, we're going to open this to the public. They will demonstrate the systems on Monday and Tuesday afternoon of the conference. That's January 19 and January 20. And you can get an invitation to see that free of charge just by emailing marketing@ptc.org. And if you email us at that address and ask for an invitation, then we'll be sending out the information to everyone who's about the times and the particulars of doing that.
And if you're interested in finding out about the conference, if you're a telecom player, where can they go for more information?
PTC.org. Everything's there. The full program is already up online. And all the participants who are there, you can see their faces and bios and everything. It's all ready to go.
Sounds fantastic. Great. Thanks, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And that's what's been happening this week. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Gwen Jacobs and Jason Lee and talk about cyber infrastructure and high-performance computing.
What constitutes the University of Hawaii's cyber infrastructure? Why is it differentiated? What about this brand-new Cray cluster? We'd, of course, love your questions as part of that conversation. So if you're with us here on Christmas Eve, you can give us a call, 941-3689, or toll-free from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689.
And, of course, we're live in the studio, and you can tweet us at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
What can we look forward to next year? How about more internet everywhere and more ways for advertisers to find us?
We're going to be connected and more effectively connected, not just by our cell connection, but by Wi-Fi all the time.
I'm Adrian Hill. The internet, ads, and everyday life. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
On the next On Being, acoustic ecologist Gordon Hempton.
Often I actually hike with another person. And often the hike in is a chattery experience coming from urban lives, etc. But the hike out is hardly talking at all. Quiet is quieting.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Sunday morning at 10, following Weekend Edition. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ferraro Choi, and Ulupono Initiative.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today is Gwen Jacobs and Jason Lee. Gwen is the Director of Cyber Infrastructure over at the University of Hawaii. Her current research efforts are focused on developing tools and approaches for data management and informatics.
Jason, meanwhile, recently joined the Information and Computer Sciences Department at UH Manoa as a data visualization expert. He developed SAGE, Scalable Adaptive Graphics Environment Software, and has become the de facto standard. It has become the de facto standard for driving ultra-high-resolution display walls around the world.
And maybe he'll get one of those 8K monitors. Yeah. And how is cyber infrastructure made available to the research community? And, of course, we'd love to hear your comments and questions while you're eating your Christmas Eve dinner. And, of course, that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Gwen and Jason, we want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Awesome to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Happy holidays to everyone.
Absolutely.
Now, you know, the word cyber has been used probably for the last, I don't know.
Since the 90s.
Yeah, 10, 15 years. And the idea of cyber infrastructure. And, of course, we commonly refer to it as the internet. Gwen, why does UH like to refer to this as cyber infrastructure?
Well, cyber infrastructure is actually a term that was coined, well, probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago at the National Science Foundation, mm-hmm. really to describe all those layers of technology that are important for supporting actually modern research. And it starts with networking, our campus, national, international networking that allows us to connect to our collaborators, send data around the world. Then there's the high-performance computing layer. Data storage, data management, all the sets of software tools, and then certainly visualization is so. All of these different technologies really you bundle them into something called cyber infrastructure.
Now, is cyber infrastructure dealt with any differently from just internet infrastructure?
Well, I'd say internet infrastructure is part of cyber infrastructure. Most of our internet infrastructure is. We refer to it as the research and education networks. Mm-hmm. And so UH has been a partner and a player on the national and international scene for many years, supporting national connections between Hawaii, our partners in Australia, and the West Coast. And most recently, cyber infrastructure also is research. So there's a lot of research that goes into creating these new technologies. And one of the new emerging technologies within networking is what people call software-defined networking. So mm-hmm. this is like bandwidth on demand. And so there's a lot of research that goes into creating the best ways to move data around, move visualizations around.
So to some extent, we're talking about internet, series of tubes, pipes, that are mm-hmm. segregated in a way or special for universities. I remember something called like Internet 2, which mm-hmm. which I thought was an education-focused separate network.
Yes, so Internet 2 is the national networking infrastructure. And what's been happening recently is really upgrading the bandwidth from 10 gigabits, I'd say, a couple of years ago. Now we're actually pushing the limits to 100 gigabits. And this is really in response to the growth of the use of large data sets, many collaborative research projects like the Large Hadron Collider. Certainly all of our astronomy that takes place in Hawaii is enabled by this network infrastructure. So we're really a global research resource here with our telescopes. That's one of the reasons that we've been partners in networking infrastructure for a while.
Well, when you talk about the 100 gig, is that 100 gig that's terminated at UH and pretty much dedicated to Internet 2 research applications?
Yes, there's a plan, and a lot of this is in collaboration with our partners in Australia, ARNET. That's their networking infrastructure. So they actually, they're part of the Southern Cross Cable Network, mm-hmm. and so they are actually upgrading to 100 gigabits, I believe, in 2016, and we will be the beneficiary of that upgrade in bandwidth.
So the 100 gig that UH is getting now, if the commercial world of internet users perhaps might have, let's say 50 gigs and they're just dying for more bandwidth, can we grab some of that from you?
This is the Research and Education Network, so it's really dedicated to that purpose.
So the answer is no.
No.
Now, Jason, you've joined UH as an innovation initiative hire, as someone who is an innovator in technologies, and we talked about your development of visualization high-definition wall screens. Maybe not 8K yet, but I'm sure you're going to be one of the first to develop content for it. One of the things that I always hear is that one of the bottlenecks for bandwidth on the consumer side or the business side is video, right? It's video content, and that's what's clogging. Everybody's on Netflix. Netflix is responsible for more than half of the traffic. And when you say it's for research and data like that, I'm thinking, how much space can a giant Excel spreadsheet take? It's hard for me to wrap my brain around how can, say, the interview from Sony Pictures take more space than a bunch of numbers from a telescope. But I think you are someone who deals with trying to get information, large amounts of information, back and forth. So can you help me understand what we're talking about
here? Yeah, certainly. So the kinds of applications that Gwen's been talking about that is going to take advantage of this Cray supercomputer are the kinds that generate so much data that your individual computers at home are really going to have a hard time, making sense of it. And that's where you need all the big fat pipes so you can move the data from computer to computer to do the processing, to actually filter all that down to a point that, you can now start to digest it using computers in your own homes. In fact, we're already doing some of this. Every time we do a search on Google, for example, when you do a search on Google, Google is the supercomputer doing all that great amount of work, and then it gets filtered down to something that you can digest. So part of what I do with Gwen is work with her supercomputer so that the large amounts of data gets digested into a visual form so that the scientists can actually make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess I might be stepping back a little bit, but you both have been pretty much involved through the Hawaii Innovation Initiative, which, we've talked to Peter Quigley on a number of occasions, and you folks are both relatively new to the UH environment. Maybe give us a little sense of where are your focus areas and how does that, let's say, play into the Innovation Initiative and how is this sort of a new area for UH?
Well, I would say that our goal really in providing cyber infrastructure support, I think the easiest way to describe it is to create an environment of friction-free research so that a researcher can concentrate on doing their research, and we do our best to create all those tools that make their research go faster, speed to discovery. And so the other thing we're really interested in is centralizing a number of those resources in our new data center, where we have a reliable power and air conditioning and really good staff to take care of all this. And this really frees the researchers up to do research as opposed to try to manage their own infrastructure. And this is a bit of a change for UH, and I think it's going to be a really important aspect. I think folks are really going to enjoy this.
Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people in the space are excited by Jason joining UH, and I can barely understand it, the kind of technology that you work with. Can you tell us about this cave that you built? Now, I know that if I had the extra room in my house, I would build a big technological cave with
big pipes. That would be called a man cave.
Right? Well, a geek cave. Oh. But is that so? What is that, and will you be? Will we see a cave at UH?
So the answer will ultimately be yes. It won't be called a cave. We're going to call it the Cyber Canoe, the Collaboration, Analysis, Navigation, and Observation Environment.
I love those acronyms.
Yeah,
fantastic.
So the cave kind of all started in 1991. This was at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where basically I graduated. Became a professor and then ultimately director of the lab that invented the cave. But just before I left Illinois, I finished something called Cave 2, which is the sort of next major step for the cave. And I think resolution-wise, the Cave 2 has about 16K resolution, not the lowly 8K we just heard.
I see.
And so my job here, essentially in Hawaii, is to bring, well, what is going to be better than Cave 2 for Hawaii, right? We can't just copy the same thing. We got to do something better.
So is this like the holodeck on Star Trek?
Yes, exactly. You've described it perfectly. That's the best way to describe it. The only difference is it's not solid, so you can't get hurt by things.
But it's all walls, ceiling.
All walls. Yeah, exactly.
Now, Jason, what are some of the sort of the key applications that you see focusing your visualization effort on?
So the key applications are really data analysis. So you imagine scientists in oceanography, in biology, who use high-performance computing resources, for example. They have so much data that their tiny little workstations in their offices just won't do anymore. These cave-like environments allow you to bring in a team of users, sit together, take all the information from their heads, from their laptops, from their computers, just throw up on the wall, you know, like something out of Batman or CSI, and actually see those connections in their data and hopefully come to a conclusion much more quickly, come to discoveries more quickly, see those connections they couldn't have seen before, you know, come to decisions with much greater precision and accuracy.
And it's the physical space. It's not like you're wearing an Oculus Rift or a cardboard headset on your head.
Yeah, it's definitely a physical space. We're not quite ready for an Oculus Rift type world yet, because people still like to see each other, make eye contact, and look at the data at the same time.
Now I have to ask you, with a cave or cave two, you must have just, you know, on one day decided to watch Star Wars or something on that giant wall.
Ironically, well, yes, because the lab that I left essentially did the computer graphics for the first Star Wars movie in the 70s.
Oh, okay.
Now, you know,
and we have an original piece of the Death Star there.
Oh, wow. So, you know, I have to harken back to this period of time in my life where I used to work at the Maui supercomputer. And that was always being sort of touted as the big iron in Hawaii and was capable of doing a lot of massively parallel computing. But I never really saw anything, I think, from a commercial standpoint, because I think for the most part, all of the work was really geared toward the DoD kinds of efforts, right? What is it about today, going into 2015, that makes, let's say, UH more capable of using the computing resources, aside from MHPCC, because that's still a DoD facility? Mm-hmm. Over the years, you know, I've always sort of looked at UH to perhaps leverage that capability. But is there something about UH now that's perhaps transitioning into a mode where, you know, there is more capability of leveraging computing or supercomputing technology?
I think the big difference between some of these other facilities like MHPCC and what we're really putting together now at UH within the Cyber Infrastructure Group is the fact that we will have professional staff scientists to help users use the machine. Uh-huh. And we also had a group of scientists help us design the machine. So when we were doing our request for proposals, when we put our bids out, we had a set of users come together and actually help us with the specifications for what kind of machine we wanted. We ended up with one that has what you call a heterogeneous architecture. So some sets of nodes are good for some types of computing. Other nodes are set up for things like large-scale data analysis, like bioinformatics analysis. So this is very much, I would call, a user-driven, user-centric machine. So this is one that we're really tying very close, and we have a great committee of UH faculty that are helping us build out our efforts. So, and we really feel that the users, I mean, they're not really users; they're our collaborators in this effort.
Now, is this the Cray system?
This is our new. So we recently did a competition, and Cray won the competition, and so we have a new Cray CS300 high performance computing system. It is now installed in our data center, and we pretty much just turned it on, and we have a couple of users that are running some of their jobs on it now.
Mm-hmm. Now, my only familiarity with Cray is almost like from Hollywood, like if it's in War Games or some movie where massive, giant, room-filling computers are unlocking the secrets of the universe, it's a Cray, you know, humming away in the corner. But it sounds to me that this is not, you know, there's no spinning tape drives, there's no hard drives. I mean, what...
No,
how would you characterize it?
It's interesting, and Jason could certainly speak to this too. I mean, there's a number of companies out there, IBM, Dell, certainly, that are in the supercomputing arena. You have different choices of the ways that you can put your systems together, depending on which vendor you go with. Cray will say that they are that their job is supercomputing. They don't really that's what they really focus on. So that's. I think if you ask the Cray folks,
right. They
are the supercomputing company.
Wasn't Cray recently acquired by another company?
I thought,
are they still a standalone?
It was acquired by Silicon Graphics at one point.
SGI, yeah, right? Another SGI. Thing that you see in movies quite a bit. So, Jason, you know, I know that when I get a new gadget for my computer, I get pretty excited. You sounds like there's now a Cray in your neighborhood. I mean, how does that make you? How do you feel about that with the work that you do?
Well, that's fantastic because then I can do and you know you can use all the power of the Cray to do all these renderings of really high resolution computer graphics, and then use the high speed networks to pump those renderings directly into this Blaze, so you can see the results instantaneously.
Now, when you when you talk about getting access to the Cray and running your renderings, are there specialized programs that you're using, or are you having something available off the shelf that you can run on the Cray?
Yeah, unfortunately, these are all very specialized programs because, again, we're talking about really the highest end stuff. So you can't just sort of go to Best Buy and just buy one of these things.
Cray,
right,
wrap, yep.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so, for example, if you look at data that geologists collect, for example, these are three-dimensional volumes of very, very dense data. And in order to really make visualizations of them, you have to have a very large computer, a Cray, basically, where you fire little rays of light, virtual light, into this dense block of data to make an image of it, like an MRI machine, like a virtual MRI machine. You take all that data back into your cave environment, and now you can dive into this three-dimensional block in your cave-like system.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember stories of UH and early computers and getting punch cards and waiting in line over Keller Hall and trying to get time on that computer to use it and run your punch cards through. And, you know, sometimes you don't even get any output after waiting in that line and running your punch cards through. Obviously, the University of Hawaii is a statewide system, and not everybody's going to be able to come to the University of Hawaii's Manoa campus to use the system. How will this Cray be accessible to people outside of Manoa?
Over the internet.
But do they go to...
So this is...
Well, is this the cloud computing part of the...
No. Well, basically, this computer will be accessible to anyone in the UH system who has a UH user account, basically. So it doesn't matter which island you're on, doesn't matter which lab you're on, doesn't matter where you are. As soon as you can have an account on the machine, You can log on remotely, run your jobs that way.
And then if you need the really high-end visualizations, you've already interviewed Chris Lee in a previous interview. So we're building these cyber canoes, one in Manoa, and then the other one is West Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
So if that succeeds, we're going to put more of these cyber canoes all over the islands, one in Hilo, one in Maui. And now you can connect all these up to your visualization center, to your Cray.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about what kind of software you would want to you could run on the Cray. So hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Gwen Jacobs and Jason Lee about leveraging high-performance computing and cloud computing over at UH.
What can the private sector learn from the university's application of this technology? Of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call at 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
An end-of-the-year reflection with Father Walter Brownridge, a visit to the state capitol in advance of next year's legislative session, plus the spirit and sounds of Kwanzaa and slam poetry, all coming up Friday morning at 8 on The Conversation.
Hi, I'm Howard Dykus. A new year isn't just a time for resolutions, it's a time to consult experts about what to expect in that new year. I consulted six. Economists Carl Bonham and Paul Brubaker, Luis Salavaria from the state government, David Uchiyama of the Tourism Authority, Joe Toy of Hospitality Advisors, Mark Dunkerley of Hawaiian Airlines. Hear what they see coming in 2015 on Howard's New Year, 8 to 10 a.m. New Year's Day on HPR2.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. And we're talking to Gwen Jacobs and Jason Lee about cyber infrastructure and supercomputers.
And, of course, right before the break, we were talking about actually using the supercomputer. And if you got a idea about running something on the supercomputer, of course, you can give us a call here. Number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. And, of course, Jason, you were talking about West Oahu College, and you know, if we are able to access, let's say, the Cray over the internet, it's over in Manoa, out in West Oahu College. Some of the students over there might be running, you know, some interesting visualizations. What program would they be running, and what would you envision to be a typical application that they might want to run on the Cray?
Well, one possibility is, you know, West Oahu has a bunch of students who are really, you know, excellent artists. So you can imagine you can involve them in taking a lot of this data and trying to create visual representations that can only be created with a large system like the Cray, and then they can look at the visualizations on their cyber canoe in West Oahu. But they can also work with students in Manoa with the cyber canoe so they can see each other, talk to each other, and then compare their approaches to visualizing that same data.
Mm-hmm. So when you were talking about this cave environment where you can sit next to somebody and be surrounded by these screens, now I would be sitting at Manoa, and I would feel like I'm sitting right next to Bert, who's at UH West Oahu, because there's a satellite system on that side?
Well, it wouldn't be satellite. It would just be over this high-speed network that we've got in all our campuses, which is what's so unique about Hawaii.
So if somebody was, and when Bert asked about the applications, I'm thinking of friends I know that do 3D renders. They're doing, they're actually doing short films, for example.
Yeah, you can make short films, exactly. Or you can make short films of scientific ideas, right, with the scientists that Gwen works with all the time.
Now, Jason, you said you were doing some work on Star Wars back at the University of Illinois?
In the 1970s, we developed the computer graphics for that the trench sequence where they trained the Rebel Alliance how to blow up the Death Star.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, at the time, computers were so new that George Lucas came along and said, you know, we want this computer-like simulation. And actually, at the time, computer graphics was sophisticated enough to do shaded models, but he wanted it dumbed down to wireframe because he wanted to make sure it looked computer-like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's a little secret that no one knows.
Oh, really? And so has the University of Illinois maintained that kind of relationship with the animation community?
Absolutely. The students who graduated from there ended up in the movie industry as well as the video game industry. And I teach video game programming, you know, for 10 years now. And I'm going to teach the same class here between West Oahu and Manoa.
So we've got a caller lined up here. We want to welcome Jerry from Maui to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Aloha, gentlemen. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, sure. How's it going, Jerry? So Well, I know you've got a question for one of our esteemed guests here.
I was going to lead in. I'm very interested in the new systems you get, both the Cray and the canoes. They sound really awesome. They tie in with some of my own previous work. Back in 30 years ago in 84, I was working on a Cray XMP making the movie The Last Starfighter.
Another good film. A very good one.
And yes. About 10 years later in 94, I was working at HRL Labs in Malibu on one of their reconfigurable caves. So real familiar with both of the setups and really excited to see that they're going to be here, especially to hear about the possible expansion to my island, and looking forward to hearing more about that.
Very good. That's a great question. So if the internet can surf up West Oahu College, I would assume that it could surf up Maui, University of Hawaii on Maui.
What's the
plan for that?
So we already have all those connections in place. This mm-hmm. was one of our other cyber infrastructure projects, was basically doing the inner island connectivity. Mm-hmm. So we have 10 gigabits to all of the islands. So certainly to all of the schools and libraries throughout Maui and all the rest of the islands. So yeah. Those connections are in place.
Now, what does it take for... Now, I know at West Oahu College, I mean, there's a whole kind of curriculum that revolves around computer graphics and design. Is there something that's happening on Maui that perhaps this could be leveraged into?
Chris Lee from Academy of Creative Media is definitely expanding out as much as possible to Maui as well as Hilo. So, yeah, definitely there are plans for that.
So, yeah. Jerry, I mean, are there things happening at the... the Maui campus that you think might be able to take advantage of this?
I would hope so. I'm not intimately familiar. We have our whole new administration coming in over there, coming out of West Oahu, as I recall, with our new chancellor. Could be very interesting to see the connections. There's a lot that can be done with it, and with the people we have on the island over with the HPCC, encouraging talent like that to stick around to play with some more open systems would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling, Jerry, and have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, gentlemen. We'll talk to you in the new year.
Thank you.
All right, that's Jerry Isdale with Maui Makers and Space Gambit and Hackerspaces and all the cool geek stuff. Definitely a good person.
Well, Maui has always been kind of on that leading edge of design and graphics and computer animation. And, of course, it was kind of born out of the fact that the Maui supercomputer was there. But to the extent where the industry has really sort of taken off, it really, didn't. But maybe the connection, having the capability and having the technical resources like yourselves mm-hmm. ready to sort of evangelize and make the resource more readily available would help to kickstart all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our goal here is this is a UH system resource. So anyone, any researcher, any student who wants to take advantage of these resources, this is really, even though it's located on the Manoa campus in our data center, it's available to anyone in the UH system.
So it's not, like the University of Manoa, right? It's
absolutely not.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Well, I know you had mentioned, Jason, at some point that there's a lot of specialized applications. Certainly at the level you're working at with the cave or the canoe is something custom built that very brilliant people like you can develop yourself. But when I think of a University of Hawaii student trying to get access to a resource like this, I think consumer-grade animation software like Maya or trying to maybe develop software for drones to model a 3D environment on the fly. And certainly if you've just got a MacBook Pro on your desk and you try to render something, you press start and then you go for a long, long walk.
Or asleep.
So how can you just walk me through? Okay, I have this great movie I'm doing about a lamp that plays with a bouncing rubber ball, but if I tried to render it on my computer, it would take 2 weeks. So how can I access this new system to have that happen faster?
Well, the advantage of systems like Maya is that they've already thought about how you can perform its rendering off your smaller computer onto a larger system. So basically most of the Hollywood movies that you watch aren't rendered on small computers. They're actually rendered on really supercomputers mm-hmm. already. So mm-hmm. it's something I think ITS has to figure out how to connect the dots with, but it's certainly technically possible. And the students could inject into the system all their rendering jobs, and the supercomputer can start chugging away, and then they would get all their frames at the end of the day.
So that's a great point. So Gwen, What is it, or maybe perhaps who on your staff would perhaps create that user interface that somebody could easily, a student could easily do a job, start it up in Maya, and actually have the rendering part of it be done on the Cray?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that's going to make our center different from someone who's maybe just buying cycles on Amazon, mm-hmm. doing their computing on Amazon. Because really, the goal is to put those experts in place in between the person who wants to use the machine and the machine itself. So having that technical expertise in place, and the way that we've been working so far is to meet with our investigators. They're our collaborators, and we walk through their needs, figure out what how best to meet their needs with the technology that we have. And so it's a real partnership. Not so much just here's your account,
right,
good
right.
luck.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
More of a helping environment. And the other thing that I would like to see happen is as more people are using the machine, we really start to build this kind of community of practice or a community of folks that are all focused on using these resources, and then they become they educate each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really trying to build a community of users that way.
Now, Gwen, this is probably just a related question or topic, but about a month ago, we covered the Jetstream initiative at the University of Hawaii, and you are playing a specific role there. I'm not sure if it's exactly supercomputing. It sounded like distributed, sort of like what Jason was talking about. Google has a million computers crunching your one request so that it happens in a millisecond. What is the Jetstream initiative?
Yeah, Jetstream is a really exciting new project. So the National Science Foundation has a number of funding programs where they really fund breakthrough new models for computing. And this is a collaboration between a number of different institutions. It's the Texas Advanced Supercomputing Center, University of Arizona, Indiana University, and really many of the leaders of cyber infrastructure got together and came up with this great idea of basically creating an academic computing cloud. So there's computing resources that are physically distributed in different areas. But what's really cool about this is that their motto is basically computing on demand anytime you want it from your laptop. So the other layer that they're going to put in place with Jetstream is to create, they put together a set of virtual machines and preload those virtual machines so that part of the cluster is specific for the type of science that you want to do. So if you're working on geology, they would have a little module for geologists. They might have one for astronomers. They might have one for oceanographers. And one of the roles that we'll play here at UH is we will be designing some of those modules specifically for our researchers here. But for a researcher who uses Jetstream, you know, they can do it from their laptop. They log in with their account. They can access their computer, run their jobs.
So it's like a remote client, but rather than having Microsoft Office or whatever installed on it, it would have geologist.com installed on it ready.
It's almost like plug and play. Pick your environment, load your data, and go.
Now, one of the areas that I think would be particularly of interest to myself is the idea of open data and open science. And given that there's so much information that a lot of the scientists and researchers are gathering as a result of their research, but when they publish their papers, a lot of the research is already, or the data is already sort of culled into their research paper, so you can't get to the raw data. What is it that you at the cyber infrastructure can provide to those researchers that make some of that raw data available?
So I'm going to answer half of this question, and then I'm going to pass it to Jason.
Okay,
for the
good. That's why we invited Jason.
Perfect question.
So really, what our goal is to be able to provide that kind of software support to make it much easier for researchers to manage their data. That is, being able to describe it, organize it, store it, and then also disseminate it out. And there's really two ways of doing data dissemination. That is, I mean, some people might be interested in your data downloaded as spreadsheets or as columns of numbers or of groups of pictures. The other really, I think, much nicer way of disseminating data is through visualizations.
Mm-hmm.
So you can create visualizations of particular experimental results and then disseminate those. And I think the audience there is both other scientists, and I think we're very interested in making the other audience really our local community. So to get our research results out into the community where they can do some good.
So, Jason, you make it pretty so it's more accessible to lay people like me.
Yeah, this is more than just D3, right?
Right. D3 is an excellent tool. Mm-hmm. I'm not knocking D3. I think what's really important to understand about visualization is that if you think about it, you know, our eyes are essentially the main sensor for the world. If we were to suddenly turn blind tomorrow, we'd all freak out. We absorb so much information in the world, it's almost a sin not to take data and depict it in some visual form, because then you're saying, well, maybe I don't want to use half of my brain, because half of my brain is actually dedicated to processing visual information. And so we see visualization as a crucial tool for actually allowing people to see what's in their data and actually starting to see whether this data is junk or actually is useful. Computers are really good at finding patterns once it knows what it's looking for, but it's terrible at making discoveries that it doesn't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And that's where we need the human's eyeballs to look at and say, oh, okay, that's a real discovery or that's junk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that because we had a recent show about research and open data and making research data available. And, of course, there are various other issues involved with that. But one of it is if you say, oh, this is a great oceanography study, give me the data, and then you suddenly find yourself with a 36-gigabyte file of numbers, really what can you do unless you're another scientist of that grade?
Right.
So, Jason, so if I was a oceanographic researcher and I made my data available, I could use a system like yours and I just twist some virtual knobs to turn it blue on this side and red on that side and make it 3D, and that's how I could explore that data.
Oh, and beyond. I mean, I have a grant from National Science Foundation where hopefully you won't even have to twist knobs. You would just talk to the computer.
Oh. Ah, so like talking to Siri? I mean,
talking to
the Cray? And
I mean, that's how scientists want to work. They actually don't want to learn all these different knobs because the knobs change all the time. But they have a certain language that they're used to using. And the way they do the visualization now is they tell their grad student to do the work.
Now, Gwen, you said a key word in your last answer, which was community. And I'm curious, how do you see the community taking advantage of these computing resources? And when I think about it, maybe you can define community. Is it people outside of the university environment?
Well, so first and foremost, this is a University of Hawaii resource, but we have many active collaborations with folks in the community. I'll give you one specific example that we're working on now. You may be familiar with the Accelerate program, which is new way to do tech transfer. So we're providing computing support to some of the Accelerate investigators. So as their businesses roll out and we create those partnerships, we're really looking for those partnerships to really share this resource.
Wow. Now, Don, you just mentioned that we recently flipped the switch on the Cray. I'm curious, with the new year coming, what's the next big milestone that you're looking forward to for the program?
Oh, that's a great lead-in, because we are looking forward to having a little kind of mini celebration rollout event early in probably the second week in January, wait until school starts again. And we will have an official kind of welcome the community, see our new resource, talk a little bit about it. We also want to have some of our scientists who are currently running their jobs on the machine to talk about the discoveries they've made and how their life is much better now.
Great. Well, we'll watch for that. Research.
Yeah, where can we find more information?
How about I send it to you?
Okay, well, we'll put it up on our show notes. And same thing with you, Jason. I mean, send me a link and I'll put it up on the show notes.
Absolutely.
Well, Gwen Jacobs is the Director of Cyber Infrastructure, and Jason Lee is a data visualization expert in the Computer and Information and Computer Science Department over at the University of Hawaii. I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really
great fun.
And thank you, yes, for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week for our New Year's Eve show as we look back at 2014 and make predictions for next year.
And if you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. And of course, you can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And please follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a band called Future Islands and a song called Sun in the Morning. Merry Christmas, everybody, and see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe. Sun in the Morning.